Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
For those inclined, joining a climate change rally can be inspiring. But those who go also say it can be scary.
Move out of the way! I'm gonna run you over! Move out of the way now!
Yeah, so what's the best way to speak up about climate change? And does it have to be protesting? I'm Rohith Joseph, a journalist who is trying to cover climate change without getting punched in the face.
Yeah, good luck with that. And I'm Johanna Wagstaff, a meteorologist who is passionate about climate change communication, but I literally could not exist without the mute button on Twitter.
And it's not in real life. Like, you can't just mute somebody who's coming up to you and saying, hey, I don't like what you say.
I don't know why we haven't invented a mute button for life yet. Yeah,
that's some Black Mirror stuff, Joe, and we don't want to go there.
No. But speaking up is one of the UN's suggested, recommended actions that an individual can take, one of their 10. Like most climate solutions, it's something we already know. We hear all the time. Talking and speaking up about climate change is something you can do as an individual. But we get stuck, you know, making this part of our daily actions. Why? Because our human brains are weird and we make strange decisions, often rooted in the status quo. We get stuck thinking nothing will help. And what does speaking up even mean? And honestly, even having the UN tell me to speak up is like the equivalent of somebody telling me to smile more. I'm like, don't.
Yeah. And our behavior expert, Jiaying Zhao, has something to say about that.
I'm Jiaying Zhao, but I go by Jay-Z. I'm a professor of psychology and sustainability at the University of British Columbia. So participating in rallies creates a sense of solidarity, social support, social connection. Every climate protest I've been to, actually, people are pretty happy. They're not angry or mad. A lot of people are smiling in those rallies. So I think make our voice heard by participating in these public demonstrations is helpful. But blocking the traffic, blocking the bridge, like, that's actually counterproductive. I mean, I get that they want to send the signal, the disruptive signal to the government, but you're disrupting the people that you're trying to engage. We must have more constructive ways to protest, to bring more people on board instead of pissing people off.
With an issue like climate change, it's also trickier because there isn't as specific or as tangible of a demand as, let's say, same-sex marriage, rallying for that. And that means it can be pretty wide-ranging. So Miles Allen, the Oxford physicist who came up with the idea of net zero, well, he gets really specific about demands.
I mean, you and I can't get rid of carbon dioxide. I mean, don't do this in your backyard, you know, folks, because, you know, you need a fossil fuel company to do that. But I think the question does need to be asked, does the taxpayer really need to pay for it when these companies are making so much money anyway? So why can't we get the result, the same result, by just requiring the companies to get rid of CO2 and prove that they're getting rid of CO2 at a steadily increasing rate in order to effectively decarbonize fossil fuels across the economy?
I was kind of envious that you got to talk to Miles. He's like one of my climate crushes. But I also, you know, respectfully only agree halfway. I love that there's a tangible ask in what he is saying. And I think that is so important when, you know, as an individual, we're trying to figure out what we want to achieve. So it is a very tangible ask that we put that responsibility back on the fossil fuel companies. But we also have to address the systems that need to change, you know, not just taking carbon out of the atmosphere, but turning to green solutions means we get a chance to shake up these systems that need changing anyway.
It can seem really overwhelming, especially when we're talking about system level change. But guess what? It is actually happening right now in Indigenous communities. So 7 years ago, West Coast Environmental Law started up this program. It's called RELAW, Revitalizing Indigenous Law for Land, Air, and Water. Basically, it gets Indigenous people to come up with their own laws to protect their territories. Here's one of the lawyers who does this work.
My name is Rayana Seymour-Huri. I come from the Anishinaabeg Nation of Treaty 3. My community is Anishinaabeg of Neongashing, and that's Big Island. Indigenous laws, you know, come from Indigenous peoples themselves. It comes from their language. It's languages. It comes from their cultures, their songs, their ceremonies. It's really connected to their territories. And it also speaks to their inherent rights and responsibilities to their territories as well. And I think a really powerful tool and way forward is shifting the way we make decisions about the natural world and about how we interact with the natural world.
Rayana told me about some great work that's happening in the Okanagan and Similkameen regions. They've managed to protect important areas, rivers that are salmon-bearing, watersheds that are crucial for the ecosystems.
All this work is generational, right? It's not going to be done in 5 years or 10 years. It's going to take decades. It's going to take even lifetimes. So my approach to the work is supporting as much as I can in the time that I have, with the goal in mind in supporting the rights of water. And I think the rights of water are like the right to flow, you know, the right to be cold or the temperature that it needs. And when we kind of resist the rights of water, then we see those massive consequences.
The rights of waters is something that I've heard from local Indigenous leaders here when it comes to reframing the words we use around sea level rise, you know, changing retreat to accommodate and reframing who the center is in that balance. Such a different worldview than I grew up with, Rohith, when it comes to our relationships with the natural world. You know, as a Hungarian, there was a lot of pride in our folklore and, you know, tales and songs about being a Hungarian. But the takeaway message was basically, like, don't steal the cookies or we're going to boil you in a pot. Like, it was very extreme. So there's a lot intense to learn here. But how can an individual, you know, emulate this sense of community in their own neighborhood, you know, on a city scale, a neighborhood block, an apartment building? Well, I've got some studies I want to share with you, Rohith,
yeah.
Obviously.
Let's get into it.
Penn State University actually conducted a study to test the impacts of two back-to-back, highly visible, large-scale climate change-related marches and what that impact was on people watching. And they got these people to fill out a survey ahead of time and then a few days after attending these marches. And the results found that these people were actually impacted by just watching these climate change marches. They felt like, as an individual, they had more power to make big change than they did before watching this march. Now, the study also found that the political leanings of these citizens was also a huge factor. So, you know, in many cases, these were people already on the fence, and watching the march just sort of spurred them to jump in. We're going to circle back on where we started, and it's probably, you know, the big tangible takeaway. Here's Jay-Z.
Go vote, because, you know, your vote matters just as much as everybody else's vote.
I mean, it had to come up, voting.
It had to come up.
You know what, though? There's still going to be people who are like, I voted and I feel like it didn't make a difference. And all right, that's why we've laid out some options here. The takeaway that I'm having from our discussion, Joe, is that there are options and different ways you can speak up about climate change. And you have to also realize that when it comes to speaking up, you're not always going to get immediate results. And that's the thing. You have to reframe your way of thinking. Even climate change coaches, that's a thing. They say you have to start thinking about, instead of, you know, feeling like there's not enough time, I don't have enough influence, think about it as you're making a start. You're starting to make a difference. So there you go. You know, some days I'm going to feel like I don't want to talk to my neighbor about installing that heat pump. It's all about what can you do in your capacity to speak up.
And I've got to say, Rohith, attended three different UN climate change conferences around the world.
All right. Stop flexing, Joe.
I know, right? It's my time here at the CBC. And you know what? Yes, these COPs are about signing papers, making these big global agreements. But for me, the biggest takeaway attending these conferences is the feeling of joy and camaraderie that I get to see in young people coming together. That's what inspires me. It's the young people, Rohith. Give me the blood of the young people.
All right there.
Just kidding. And that's 10 minutes before things get creepy. Too late. You've been listening to 10 Minutes to Save the Planet from CBC Podcasts. The show is written and hosted by Rohith Joseph and me, Johanna Wagstaff. Our producer is Teresa Lalonde. Sound design by Jill Constantine.
Fabiola Carletti is our digital coordinating producer with assistance by Sean Lloyd. Our managing producer is Damon Fairless. Executive producers are Cecil Fernandez and Chris Oak.
Tanya Springer is the senior manager of CBC Podcasts.
And Arif Nourani is the director.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.